That I want to make sure everybody knows that I don't come to this work as like a do-gooder trying to help poor people. It's really important, I think, that we all get real with ourselves about the role, the disproportionate role that some powerful corporations and that some powerful people have in our lives and in our decision making. And they've interfered with me in a really big way, right? I mean, banks got their hooks into my parents so early, right? I mean, I grew up in a family that was just buried in debt. And I grew up in a world that didn't pay teachers enough. Both of my parents are teachers. And I grew up in a world where, I mean, we bought into the 1980s housing bubble, right? So my family suffered under that housing bubble. And so I've seen in my personal life, right, ways that there are decisions that I didn't get to make because some corporate power made it for me. The biggest manifestation of that for me was when I turned 18, I didn't get to go to college the first year out of high school. And the reason is that when you fill out the FAFSA form, there was no place to report what was actually happening to my family, the trouble with the bank that we were actually having and the actual issues that we were facing. And it looked on paper like, I mean, what FAFSA thought my parents should be able to contribute was like completely out of line with any reality we were looking at on the ground. Now, I ended up getting to go to school, found a way to do it. But when I was 18, what I really wanted to do was go to college. And I'd done everything right. I had great grades. I'd done all that stuff. And I didn't get to do it because of what, because of the way banks had structured our lives, right? And so from my perspective, the work that I do is not helping poor people, right? Like, I'm somebody who wants more power in my life, and I want my neighbors to have more power in their lives, right? I'm someone who lives next door to a vacant house and across the street from another one. I'm someone who lives in a neighborhood where I have real concerns about sending my hypothetical future kids to the school down the street.
What school?
It's Sheridan Elementary. It's the closest one to us, right? And they've gone through a lot of turnover lately. I know they're trying to pick things up, but it's going to take the community really getting involved. And I think that's just starting to happen. And the next closest school to me is Webster, which is closed, right? And so I have a lot of reasons to be personally invested in this, and I want to make sure that that's where this conversation comes from, that that's sort of how we think about this work. And I want to challenge everybody, as you think about engaging in this work, to think about the ways that you're personally affected by what is happening in the world we're living in, right? So that brings me to NOC. Neighborhoods Organizing for Change, I think, to me, feels like a really important organization. Our mission's pretty simple. We're building a powerful member-led organization, and member-led's really key, that is organizing in low and moderate income neighborhoods around the Twin Cities. Our membership density is strongest in the lowest income neighborhoods, so North Minneapolis is where we've done the vast majority of our work in the last year. We have members in Frogtown Rondo area and members on the east side of St. Paul and some in Phillips. We've started a Northeast neighborhood chapter, which is kind of an interesting new development just in the last few weeks, so I'm excited to see where that goes. And our mission is to build power for people in those communities, right? And in order to build power, I think that involves taking a little bit of power from the people who are currently making decisions, right? And so we've got to think real seriously and real pragmatically about who that is and what it's actually going to mean to elevate voices from within the community. Right now, what ends up happening is that everybody feels incredibly alone with the decisions that they're making, right? If you're facing foreclosure, which, by the way, 11,000 homes were foreclosed on in the first 6 months of 2011, so you're not alone if you are. 11,000, I think that's in Minnesota for the first 6 months. So that's still really crisis levels, right? We're not hearing people talk about it nearly as much, or if they do, people kind of are confused about maybe HAMP did something, maybe the Obama administration has some kind of solution, maybe mortgage modification is working. But what's happening is all 11,000 of those people, all 11,000 of those families were made to feel incredibly alone with the decision they were facing. They were made to feel like, I made this bad call, I shouldn't have bought this house, I made a mistake. If I was just a little more thoughtful with my money, if I had just managed this a little better, somehow I wouldn't be at fault. But if there's if we're on track to have 22,000 Minnesotans get foreclosed on this year, it's a community crisis, right? And it's something that we need to help people not feel alone with. We need to help people understand that this is something that's happening to our neighborhoods. And yeah, they might have made some bad decisions along the way, but ultimately, who among us hasn't? And some of us get the luxury of doing that and not having to face steep consequences for it. But in a lot of cases right now, what really needs to happen is we need a lot of people speaking with one voice because the banks have all the power in that relationship if it's between a bank and a single homeowner. And so we've got real work to do to bring people together. And that's a big piece of what we're trying to do. Now, we work on two major issues. We work on schools, and we work on housing. The housing fight has been focused mostly on foreclosure issues. And we started off last year doing a huge door knocking campaign. We knocked on 3,500 doors, all volunteers, out talking to people in the community about the foreclosure crisis. And here's what we found. We had one really exciting victory right off the bat that got me really excited about the campaign. We found somebody who was the victim of a mortgage scam. Somebody had come around and tried to charge her money for negotiating with the bank on her behalf, which is illegal in Minnesota. I want to make sure everybody knows that, because these folks are out there. And we were able to help her package her case and get it to the Attorney General and get her money back, which was a really cool way to start the campaign. From there, it really fizzled. We knocked on thousands of doors, and we referred hundreds of people to mortgage modification services, right? There's a lot of really good nonprofit mortgage modifiers, and practically nobody got their loan modified. The banks are just not working with people. And so what we found was ultimately the sort of case-by-case work that we were really hoping to do and trying to do and trying to build momentum on was getting us absolutely nowhere. It wasn't really helping anybody, and it wasn't building any kind of collective power as we work on individual cases. And so we've really, at this point, what we're trying to do is to think about how can we be systemic in our analysis? How can we really start pushing the banks to behave differently at a much bigger picture level? And when you start to ask that question, you start to run into some really frustrating realities, right? This sort of circles me back to why I'm not thinking about partisan politics right now. I'm going to steal from, do any of you know Stephen Lerner? Have you listened to him speak much? Stephen Lerner from SEIU. I think he's one of the smartest speakers on this, and so I'm going to just steal from him outright on a couple of things that are points that he makes when he's talking. And here's the first one. If you follow European politics, and I only follow it enough to have a basic understanding of this, so don't ask me too many follow-up questions, but Greece and Ireland had very different election results. Greece elected a socialist government. Ireland elected a center-right government. And they're both enforcing the exact same austerity measures that were forced on them by the exact same financial institutions, right? Now, at a certain point, you have to start to look at that and say, okay, so do elections even matter? Do I even care? Now, don't panic, Phyllis. I'm not going to say that elections don't matter. I do think that when we think about power, we have to think both about who we want to elect, but also making sure that they have enough power to do anything once they get there, right? I think it's crucially important. I am terrified, for instance, at what Standard & Poor's pulled off this week, right? Who here voted for Standard & Poor's? Now, they're basically, I mean, they just downgraded our country, right? And they're doing it, I mean, largely because they think we're spending too much, that we didn't cut enough. They don't like our policies. And so they, a for-profit corporation, made a set of decisions that's wreaking havoc on our market, and it's going to cost us billions of dollars, right? And that's them imposing their order. We didn't elect them, and I don't think we should give them that power. Yeah.
Didn't they say we need to balance the budget?
It's true. They've been critical. They've been critical, right. They've been critical of the people who said just, like, let it default, too, right? And that voice was part of why they did it. But a big piece of that was that they wanted to see more cuts.
I'm alarmed about how the lack of revenue sort of, like, disappeared from the compensation.
Yeah.
I mean, they're not saying just cut. They are saying balance the budget.
Yep. Yep.
Mm-hmm. But they're also saying get a process, you know, learn to make decisions that make sense.
Right. And so in our decision-making process, right, we elected people to do that. And they're intervening. They've got a much louder voice than I do or you do, right? And so I want to think real seriously about that because it's not just Greece and Ireland, right? It's happening here. Yeah.
No one's saying that balancing the budget includes revenue.
Well, right.
I just went to a terrific talk with a fundraiser that Walt's getting.
Yep.
And he said this concept of balance, because I don't remember what the issue is, but he presents data from the Mayo Clinic, from the Dartmouth Review, and so forth. And then the paper publishes a reputation by Michael Broadcom. I mean, because they want balance.
Right. Right. Absolutely. Absolutely.
That's not to defend Standard & Poor's or take away the points.
Right, right, right. No, I think that's really important. Now, to get to sort of Stephen Lerner's point that he's making, if you look at one of the arguments that we made, one of the ways that we end up positioning our arguments is kind of appealing to that corporate set of decision makers about our needs, right? We do a lot of this messaging. Fight for the middle class. Protect the middle class, right? There's this sort of Henry Ford logic that says, they need us, right? If we don't get paid enough to buy their products, then they can't have a functioning market and they can't hold on to their wealth. And one of the shifts that I think needs to happen is we need to stop pretending that that's an effective strategy, right? I think we really need to stop pretending that the wealthiest in this country who are making a disproportionate number of decisions actually care whether we're middle class or not. They have, at this point, an international consumer base that makes us surplus to requirements, right? And I think that getting to a point where we can be real about that, where we can say we no longer have corporate leaders who care about our well-being, who are invested in our well-being, It's
a blanket thing that's, I mean, you've got Mark Dayton who would fit in that category. He's not there. He's not saying that.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm afraid.
Yeah.
Can we hold
the
discussion
until
okay.
after the presentation and then we'll go for it?
Oh, sure.
Is that okay?
Yeah, that's okay. No, that's good. And Jeremy also asked me to be provocative enough that we'd get good Q&A going after I stop. So hopefully we've done a little bit of that and we can get some good questions going. So I want us to... So we're at least framing our work, I think, in a way that says we're not going to pretend that somebody's going to give us this because it's in our mutual self-interest, right? We're not going to pretend that if low-income people in the Twin Cities are going to have more power and have more access to wealth and have more access to opportunity, that somebody is going to just give that to us out of benevolence or out of a sort of paternalistic sense that this is good for everybody, a rising tide lifts all boats. We need to take it, right? We need to make it happen, and we need to really be a little more forceful in our thinking around these issues. And so we're moving from a model where when we work on foreclosures, we're working on individual cases. And when we work on schools, we're appealing to the school board, right? And the school board's forced into terrible decisions that they hate all the time, right? Because they're getting less and less money. And we can keep yelling at the school board about how they're making those cuts, or we can start asking why don't they have any money. And I can tell you, as someone who's door-knocked, especially around the North High School fight, right? Like, we got very involved in the North High School fight, and it was a great example of how a community can come together and make a real difference. But at the same time, the thing that the school board was saying was true also, right? There weren't enough kids. And when you start to ask why aren't there enough kids, it's really obvious to anybody who door-knocks in that neighborhood. When you're door knocking, you go down a block, not home, vacant, okay, we talk to that person, vacant, okay, we talk to that person, right? And in fact, if you add up the number of vacant homes, and the average home in Minneapolis has 1.2 kids in it, it would more than fill up the schools that we're having a hard time filling right now, right? Minneapolis has lost a lot in this foreclosure crisis. And so instead of yelling at the school board, we're starting to play with what would it look like to try to yell at the banks What would it look like instead of taking our fight to people who are trying to do more and more with less and less? Start to ask, why do we have less? And start to get serious about holding people accountable in that regard. So we're starting to try to think differently, which is not to say that we're not engaging in the other reform questions, right? We just did a really huge parent survey that I'm really excited about that I hope you'll all come to a big release event that we're going to have in September to talk about issues that parents are facing in the schools, many of which are not related to funding, although almost all of them would require more funding to get serious about it, right? This revenue question is so important. But we have an opportunity to think through all these things at the same time, to think through both what would we want the school board to do if they had the resources and really engage them in that conversation in a serious way and build community power, because we think that community institutions are always stronger with more community involvement, and how do we fight for the funding to actually make those communities powerful, right? One other thing that I want to mention, and I have a handout that starts to show the ways that we're thinking about, do you want to help me get this out? The ways that we're thinking about this question. There's actually been a lot of really good attention paid. How am I doing on time, by the way? I forgot to even check. Plenty of time. All right. There's been a lot of attention paid lately, I think, to the way corporate voices are intervening in politics, right? People have heard about ALEC, right? That's sort of familiar territory. And people have heard of, no? All right. So there's this group called ALEC that many of our legislators here in Minnesota and around the country are members of, that essentially is a think tank, a sort of that writes bills for them to pass that advance a certain set of corporate interests, right? And they've been very interested in taking money out of the public schools through voucher programs, through privatization programs. That's been a big part of ALEC's agenda. And there's a lot of questions right now, I think, about whether they're violating lobbying rules and whether they're violating campaign finance rules. We can think about all that stuff. But pulling back the curtain on some of the ways that corporations and legislators are getting together to really, you know, make decisions and work with each other, I think is really important. Everybody's heard about the Koch brothers' involvement in sort of funding Tea Party activities and funding a lot of the campaign activities, especially in Wisconsin. They've drawn a lot of attention to that. But one of the things that doesn't get called attention to enough is the ways that they're really setting themselves up directly for profits. And so I kind of love this little infographic because it draws a very direct connection between, on the one hand, lobbying really hard through the Chamber of Commerce and other vehicles in support of candidates who would hold back revenue, right? So some corporate leaders, particularly, I'll name John Campbell from Wells Fargo, who's the chair of the Chamber of Commerce, have taken a really active role in helping to elect legislators who will hold the line on revenue, right? That results in this school shift, right? That's what we ended up with, where money gets sort of held back from the schools to be repaid at a later date, and we're up to $2.1 billion right now, right? $700 million in this session. And now the schools are being forced to take out loans, right? This is the piece of the circle that I want us to draw over and over and over again, is that the people who made the decision to hold the line on revenue in the first place, who made the investment to make sure that was the result we got, are now profiting from it. They are charging decent interest rates, pretty high in some cases, to our schools for the short-term borrowing that they need to do to make up for the school shift. So it's not just that they didn't have to pay taxes. It's that they're now profiting, and every dollar that's going to interest, every dollar that's going to debt servicing is coming out of our kids' classrooms, right? We should all be outraged about that, and I want to call attention to it again and again and again, especially after our TARP bailout money gave them that money that they're loaning out for free, right? So our taxpayer money subsidized their profits, and now they're pulling money out of our classrooms. I want to draw those connections as explicitly as we can, and I think that's where we need to focus over and over and over again, so that whoever ends up getting elected in 2012 actually has the power to do something when we get there. So I think, on that note, I want to wrap up and get to Q&A. Yeah?
The ALEC thing is is really important. My attention just really, I had heard about and didn't pay much attention because there's just so many things you can pay attention to. But the importance of it was really brought home to me by some people I'm in touch with in Georgia who have made it their priority. And something at legislative something commission, and you're right, it is Koch funded, but the other piece that's funding it, that is this incredibly wealthy family that is pouring money into eliminating public education. That's it, eliminating public education. And it's just something that you can't believe when you hear it, if you hear it. So it's kind of a big piece that isn't known. And then that goes to my next point, is we've got to connect the dots on the big pieces, and you just put some in very key details in place. But we have to start talking about what's right. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can't talk dollars and cents with them because right. We'll never win. But it's got to get to a moral level of this is just not right. This is not democracy. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thanks.
Could people raise their hand and be recognized by the speaker and then say your name?
Sure.
Yeah. Ruth Usum. And can we go back to what I was talking about earlier?
Sure, yeah.
So far, a lot of the good that's been done in the poor communities are people who have means and have time and can help. So how do we then begin to appeal to their moral and their goodness that many of them really want to do? And I'm afraid if we, as I was just saying to Phyllis, if you cannibalize the corporate world, you're done. Money doesn't trickle up. Money trickles down. And we have to find a way to engage those people that have means and help them do the good. Mm-hmm. So where are you on that?
Well, I think that this story that we tell that money trickles down isn't proving true anymore. It's actually not really doing that. And so I think that that's part of the challenge that we face, right? Is that I mean, in principle, I want to agree with you, right? I want to say, like, okay, I mean, it's exciting that, like, you know, corporations are giving money to the schools or setting up a health clinic, and I mean, that stuff is important, but I also think that we're really giving up the game if we give them too much credit for that, because they've been fighting for the revenue cuts that led to us needing a health clinic in the first place, right? I mean, there's a certain point where I think we need to start engaging people in talking about doing what's right by paying taxes, right? And by not insisting on setting the terms of their donations and planting their flag with their big corporate logo on it, but actually just contributing to society so that we have healthcare in the first place, instead of bending over to thank them too, you know, aggressively, right? Like, spending too much effort on that once they're making up for a gap that they created by not paying their taxes. And so I guess that's my sense, is that I both appreciate the immediate urgent needs that they feel, right? I think it's really important. There's some really good work going on, and I think it's really important that we get to asking why. Those needs needed to be filled in the first place, because they shouldn't have. It's a failure of our, like, civic life that we needed a health clinic in North Minneapolis, and that some corporation needed to chip in and build it. Yeah.
Don Ostrom, I'd like to follow up on what Ruth said. I think it's great that you're organizing on the north side, that you're organizing low and middle income people, but I'm a little concerned that you seem to be writing off political parties and also the upper class, because it does make a difference whether you have a Governor Dayton or a Governor Walker in mm-hmm. place, whether you have Phyllis and people like her as the yep. committee chairs or the people that we have at the current time. And similarly, the upper class is not monolithic. There
right.
have always been elements. Now, in the not too recent past, we had fairly strong elements in the business community in Minnesota that was progressive, that was contributing to the society privately, and also a lot of their
government actions that we value took place when the Republicans were in office. And right now, the go it alone, not worrying about the people below, has been dominant in that group. But that can change, too.
Yeah.
So I think, yeah, continue to do your work, but also make the connection that it makes a difference as to what elements of the upper class do and what happens in elections.
Oh, sure. I think that's right. I've been thinking a lot about this. A lot of our members get stereotyped a lot, right? In North Minneapolis, there's this amazing thing that happened where, like, a couple of people broke a window in a liquor store, and the immediate reports were like looting, disorder, right? All this stuff. And that stereotyping so rarely gets called out, but you stereotype rich people, man, people get on you about it, right? At the same time, I take your point, and I think it's really important. And I mean, talk to me in an election year. I'll probably be speaking a little different tune, right? It's easy in 2011 to be, you know, a little dismissive of election results. I will say this, though. There are an awful lot of Democrats who are actually not going to make a difference for poor people, who are actually not committed enough to working to make a difference for poor people. And when you ask people who are really struggling to care about an election where neither person is going to help them, neither person is actually going to stand up for programs that would matter to them, it's a question of who's going to cut less out of the services they depend on. You're not going to get people fired up, and it's actually it is getting to a point in some debates, right, and in some cases where we really need to think seriously about what we can do to make at least one of the parties relevant to huge portions of the population in the Twin Cities. And I think that we're not there right now. There's some really good people. There's some really good individual politicians. There are some really good people I know in the DFL. You know, I grew up in the DFL. That's sort of where my personal relationships are and connections are. And there are a lot of people who feel very comfortable fighting for the middle class and not really thinking about whether that fight for the middle class is even touching people who aspire to maybe someday be middle class, or who don't think that they'll ever be middle class. And it's actually a huge part of the population. And I'll say this, in the conversations about thinking about the election right now, when I sit down with my friends who are really strategizing around elections and who think about numbers and who think about this stuff, right now, I mean, people take for granted, I hear this all the time, it's amazing. People just say, oh, everybody in North Minneapolis is going to show up for Obama, right? We don't need to invest in civic engagement in North Minneapolis because everybody's just going to show up for Obama. Where we need to invest in civic engagement is in middle-class suburban districts where we just barely lost legislative races, right? And don't get me wrong, we do need to invest there, but if we don't invest in engaging people in this election all over the state, it's a huge lost opportunity, and it's especially important on ballot initiatives, right? Because there's going to be probably multiple ballot initiatives. We only know of the one so far, the marriage discrimination bill. But there's probably going to be multiple ballot initiatives, and those are going to be a lot tighter. People are predicting Klobuchar is going to walk. People are predicting Obama is going to walk. Nobody in either party is investing too much in those races, I don't think, in Minnesota. I don't think they're thinking of it as a battleground. And we really run a risk of falling down on some ballot initiatives because people are just not thinking about engaging low-income communities. I think that's a really, really problematic way of thinking.
But Wright's going to turn out big time for that marriage ballot.
Well, I, so go ahead.
That's all I'm saying. I mean, this is designed to get their base out. We're going to get creamed, progressives.
I have to say, I'm not convinced that that's true. I am convinced that that's what they're calculating. I'm not, because they're, I mean, they put something on the amendment that changes nothing, right? They put something on the amendment that reaffirms what's already the legal position. And nobody would spend that much money and put that much effort into changing nothing. So they obviously think they're changing something by doing this, so it must not be the effect of the bill. They obviously have a strategy. I have to say, I think... we have two roads to go down, and I'll credential myself a little on this. I worked on the No on 8 campaign in California, the No on Proposition 8 campaign in California. So in, you know, in California, gay marriage was legal for a period of time, and then there was a ballot initiative to change that, and I was part of the No campaign, and we made huge mistakes on that campaign. And the biggest mistake was being afraid to actually talk about the issue. Because it turns out when you actually talk about the issue, when you're actually honest and passionate about something and you give people something to connect to, you can move people, right? There are a lot of people who were horrified. I mean, we did this whole follow-up project in Santa Cruz County that was really fascinating, where we talked to people. We did a really intentional effort in the months after the election to engage people who voted yes, and to make them talk to somebody who identified as LGBT, and to really like force a conversation. And as soon as they figured out, oh my gosh, I actually know gay people. This actually affects somebody I know who wasn't out to me, who we weren't talking about it. It changed the way they would vote if the ballot initiative came up again. Now, what the No on 8 campaign did, they were running commercials that actually depicted a straight couple. And there were barriers being put in the bride's way as she was going down the aisle, and it said, what would happen if someone wouldn't let you marry who you wanted to, right? But they never said gay. They never said anything about what the actual issue was. And it was like they were afraid of it. And when you run like you're afraid of something, or when you run a campaign like you're afraid to actually call it out, if we ran a campaign that said we kind of think there should be more funding, but we're not going to name the banks, right? We're not going to actually say who's doing this to us. You don't give anybody an opportunity to get passionate with you, right? And so I think I'm concerned about that campaign right now pulling its punches too much. I'm concerned about them playing it way too safe in the way they frame it. I think there are going to be groups that join the bigger coalition around that who should be more moderate. But I think that I'm concerned about the campaign as a whole being too moderate right now. And I think if we energize people and we get people passionate, we could turn our base out as much as they can turn theirs out. I really think that.
I'd like to get back to the moral issue that Phyllis is talking about, mm-hmm. And I'm rather naive, but I get crazy with thinking that I'm going into the McGuire Theater at two of our art places, and why that guy isn't in jail, and he took all this money from the healthcare industry, and then he gets praised for having these theaters, and we don't do anything about it. I mean, that seems so obvious that this city has not done anything with McGuire. He's not sitting in jail. He's one of many, many, many people right here in our community. How do we get them? I mean, that's a moral issue. How do we, as a community, doesn't make any difference if you're Republican or Democrat or whatever. That's outrageous. But everybody is helping everybody else, and everybody's afraid to say anything because they're going to lose their funding. They're going to lose this. They're going to lose that.
Mm-hmm.
That's the simple.
I think you brought it right down to a specific example of power and right and wrong.
Yeah, I mean.
And this is an important point too. Going back to your point, right? Is that part of the. Part of the problem of unchecked and unregulated wealth and the really disproportionate and unethical ways that people are able to throw their wealth around is a big part of why sort of ethical wealth doesn't get recognized, right? It's really getting dwarfed. I mean, the people who have some resources but behave ethically and morally and are pretty decent people, frankly, like, their voice isn't getting heard that much. Dayton's kind of a weird standout in that way, right? There are people who quietly give to foundations. There are people who are, like, sort of behind the scenes doing some nice work. And that's important. It's really important. And I'm actually not usually saying, rich people as my sort of framing, right? But corporate power is much more the way I'm thinking about this. But the truth is, yeah, I think if there were some rules that actually applied to them and that could actually be applied to them in a meaningful way, I think that would make a difference in the overall climate and how we could think about this stuff.
I can't speak to that.
You
know, I'm just saying,
how do we get him to be an advocate?
How do you get those?
I don't know. We got him to build theaters. That's probably as close as we're going to get.
Are living on what they did illegally, in my mind, whether it's drugs or whether it's alcohol or whatever, because we know drugs cannot get in this country without corporate America allowing it to happen.
I mean, I've been in that field for my whole life, and I know that it doesn't happen without corporate America allowing it to come in. Then they make money, and along with all kinds of other illegal things that I think of on a moral issue, that's illegal. It may not be illegal.
I don't know enough about him to know. You know what? But
I'm talking about our whole. They make money and then they turn around and give money away. But it's usually the kids or the grandkids that are giving the money away, not the ones that oftentimes have made it.
And the tax write-off.
And the vanity. Yeah. And the vanity.
Phyllis, anything?
First of all, I know this. Let me say something almost in defense of Alec. There are counterparts on the other side. Sandy Pappas and I are the state directors of something called Will Wong. Women's Institute for Legislative Leadership and Women's Action in New Directions. And we used to spend, we don't spend any House Senate money now on out-of-state travel. But when I was chair of a committee and had a committee budget and legislators asked to go to the ALEC conference, I always sent them because I always believe that it's a good idea for legislators to talk to legislators in other states. We also send them to the Will One conference, too. There's another group called the National Legislative Environmental Caucus, or something like that, which is that. And these are now depending on foundation support to give scholarships and things like that. But I just, you know, I think that ALEC has been over, just because it has this big source of funding. I think it's good for legislators in other states to talk to each other. One of my Democratic colleagues, and I just, former colleagues, I just called him to check it out. He used to always go to the ALEC conferences because he wanted to see what they were doing. And, you know, so I really think that that's been, you know, that's been overblown as a major issue.
Can I just throw in a question?
Oh, the time frame, because things have really changed in the last 10 years.
Well, one of the things that we're looking about, I did some calling into, unfortunately, one of the losing Wisconsin races, and there was kind of an outrage of the amount of money going in. I know when people tell you, I was going to vote for the Democratic candidate, and I got so many calls, I'm now not, you know, that they were, you know,
they
that,
were
that's not,
anyway, yeah.
that that's not true. But the, you know, the basic issue is that you have to get people out to vote. The number I'm putting out, and I'm actually in the ad that I designed for the Labor Day party of the Minneapolis Labor Forum, you know, I put in parentheses, it has been said that 240,000 union members voted for Scott Walker. Another thing that happened in that race, which gives me some hope for this, is I have a relative who's, let's say, the husband of a sister of my daughter-in-law. And he's a St. Paul policeman, a young guy, a St. Paul policeman. And before the Franken Coleman election, and that was kind of like just before the election, so I had huge amounts of stuff I had to do. But because we were hanging out with grandkids and cousins, I spent an entire afternoon convincing him to vote for Franken instead of Coleman. And it was in his personal interest to do this as a St. Paul policeman with a stay-at-home wife, etc. And I didn't ask him, but he did tell me that he did, and I do believe him. And now, at this point, he came up to me the last time the kids were all in town, and we were talking, and he said, you know, all my life I've voted between Republicans and Democrats, and after seeing Scott Walker in Wisconsin, I am solidly Democrat. So hopefully there's a whole set of people like that. I was even able to talk them into going to vote for Mary Jo McGuire in a special election. So that's a real, you know, except I can't give that much individual attention to every fringe voter.
Right.
But I mean, I think that's a very positive development.
Yeah. Although with the amount of money that we spent right on some of those recall races, we practically could have, right? If we'd actually just said, like, you take these 10 instead of, like, you call these 200 people. Like, you know, like, you sit down for one-to-ones with people and, like, really, like, organize it. It would be sort of fast.
I mean, well, sure. What, even though I'm calling allegedly a Wisconsin phone number and saying I'm with a group we always come, you know, I really think that for a legislative district race, you got to do it in the district.
I think that's right. But to get back to the ALEC point, the more striking thing for me, and the thing that I think is actually really even more than the money, because, right, like, I mean, like you said, foundations will put up money to do stuff, and there's all kinds of different ways to think about funding this stuff. But even more than that, the way they're game planning, I mean, the way that the proactive agenda that ALEC has built is just something we don't have on our side, right? The people who really believe in public schools and really want to see public schools be strong and vibrant. I mean, I can tell you, like, I think I'm part of the forefront of that. Frankly, I'm part of a national coalition called Communities for Excellent Public Schools that's been really engaging in some intense work. But seriously, we cannot get out of a defensive frame. We cannot get out of, like, how do we make some subtle changes to No Child Left Behind when it gets reauthorized? How do we push back against? I mean, we're still trying to undo what George Bush did in 2002, right? So, like, how do we get to a point that we're looking 10 years down the road and saying, here's what we really want, and here's the, like, pieces of legislation that all need to add up like bricks, right, to actually build to the future that we see? It's amazing. I think that we didn't even understand what was happening to us in a lot of cases as a movement, right? As some of these smaller bills were being passed that were laying the groundwork for some of the bigger ones. And that's the thing, more than anything else, that I want to take from ALEC, is to say, look, they've got a really clear agenda that's being written by corporate lobbyists. And if we want an anti-corporate agenda, if we see something that puts power in people's hands and not corporations, we are way behind, right? We are way behind in doing that thinking and in creating that proactive agenda and in getting to a place where people are going to have more power. And we need to get serious about that, like, yesterday. And frankly, I'm ambivalent about this question of, like, should we do it by forming our own ALEC? And, like, trying to do whatever we can to stockpile money and resources? Or is there a different way to do it? I think at a certain point we have to think about what's powerful and what's actually effective. And I'm not sure. But I do think that as you look at the scope and the detail of the planning that they've done and of the legislation that they've devised, it should scare all of us who see a different vision than theirs.
I'll wait for the microphone
to approach.
So I'm Jeremy.
Yes.
I'm proud to say that at one point, as the result of a tirade, Wells Fargo asked me to leave as a customer. Okay?
Wow.
Yes. Wells Fargo asked me to leave as a customer. They gave me a list of banks that they suggested I go to.
What were their suggestions?
I don't recall. For those of us who really dislike organizations like a Wells Fargo, but still also recognize that, you know, capital's got to move, right? Businesses grow because we can borrow money. I can buy a house because I'm borrowing money. Are credit unions really the only place to go? Are there other opportunities for capital to move? What are you seeing in terms of organizations that fill some of those banking roles that are helping you?
Yeah. Well, I think, I mean, in terms of that question, right, there's a lot we can learn from the sort of socially responsible investment movement, right? Where, I mean, in the way that they think about this stuff, it's not a binary. It's not like there's good and bad. I'm not going to tell you credit unions are all good. They went to the mat last year on retail fees. That they want to maintain the rights to charge consumers, right? So, like, that was their credit union lobbying effort. So I'm not 100% going to tell you that there's no complicity, right? I mean, like, we're in a system where you're always complicit in, you know, acting in it, right? Land was seized to build this coffee shop that we're in, right? Like, there's a certain point where, like, we have to be real about that. You got to put your money somewhere. Credit unions are not a bad place. Bremer functions as a nonprofit bank. I would tend to think about, like, small local banks that are investing in the community and where they make their lending decisions maybe with a person in the bank, right? Whether it's a credit union or a for-profit bank. I think that we have to think real seriously about too big to fail. I mean, for me, that's the filter that I would use. For me, the question is, I mean, there's basically five banks that are responsible for the foreclosure crisis, right? The ones that were buying up all of the bad loans that were made by all of the small mortgage brokers all over the country, And at this point, because of the way they've merged, it's down to five. It's U.S. Bank, it's Wells Fargo, it's Bank of America, it's Chase, and it's Citi, right? I'm not going to bank with those five if I'm choosing a banking account, because I'm really angry at what they did to our communities. Everybody's going to have to decide what their filter is for themselves, right? I would think about who's lobbying for what is a really good thing to look at. Who's sitting on the Chamber of Commerce board, and do you agree with them? I would think about, you know, I think there's a lot of different ways to make that filter, but you're never going to find a place to keep your money where I'm going to tell you you're not at all complicit. So there's no perfect solution, but we can all do better than the five that are really tearing apart our housing. Yeah.
I want to defend Jim Campbell, whom I know when he was working at Wells Fargo and now in retirement. He's very community-oriented.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'd like to ask you, you use the term poor. Is that something like pornography? We all know when we see it, but we can't define it. Or your organization, how do you define poor?
You know, in terms of mapping out our neighborhoods that we initially looked at, we looked at median income in the neighborhoods. We use the city. Yeah. Yep. And in a lot of neighborhoods, I mean, that leaves you talking to, I mean, if you take a whole neighborhood, right, like you look at Phillips is really economically diverse in a lot of ways, right? And we're talking to everybody in that neighborhood. So it's not like everybody who's a member of our organization meets some criteria of poor. We don't have an income screen, right, to become a member. But at the same time, I mean, we're not going to Kenwood to knock on doors, right? I mean, and I think we have a sense of that. The interesting thing about, because you're right, and in fact, we just did an action at Wells Fargo downtown on Wednesday that was specifically protesting their political contributions to congressional candidates who were cutting revenue, right? Or who were pushing back against revenue increases. And I had the interesting experience. I was actually videotaping from the Skyway for the action, so that was sort of my role. I wasn't down with the protesters. And so a bunch of Wells Fargo executives walked past in the Skyway, and they were looking at it, and we had this big blown-up mask of John Campbell and of Michelle Bachmann and the other congressional delegation that he had contributed to. And some people said exactly what you just said, right? They said, well, he's so community-oriented. He, you know... Right, you're right. You mentioned his brother, but
Fargo, he was very community.
Yeah. No,
and
he
still is in retirement.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. And in fact, they've had a strategy for a long, long time of making sure that they do 2-day trainings for their executives about how to serve on a board, how to serve on philanthropic boards, right? And they've made sure that foundation money isn't coming to knock, right? they've really done a good job of making sure that organizations that are going to use that money to turn around and picket Wells Fargo are not getting funded, right? And so, well, but let's take this seriously, right? So there are voices that are going to get heard, that are going to get amplified because of where philanthropic money is going. And that's not necessarily philanthropic money that's being given by Wells, right? But Wells has managed to have a big voice in how it gets distributed anyway. And so if the question on the table is, we need banks to behave differently in our community, if that's the community voice that's rising up, that voice isn't getting funded. If the voice that's rising up is, please help us, philanthropic leaders, bring in the health clinic that we shouldn't have to lobby for anyway, that voice gets a ton of funding. Right? And that voice gets a ton of resources. And so how we organize philanthropy, how we think about funding, and who pays for what, Headwaters is really the only foundation right now that's funding organizing.
Funding what?
Organizing, as opposed to giving. Right? So if somebody actually wants to get out and organize people and do advocacy work, there's very little foundation money going to that, you know, locally here in the Twin Cities. And that's a change. And that's a change that's been enacted by design over the last 10 years, right? That was part of an agenda. Yeah.
So what you're describing is a move in the philanthropic community from let's teach people how to fish to
let's enslave them by making them dependent on our fish. And would you agree with that description? And if so, would you say it's intentional or accidental?
Enslave's probably not the word I would use, but I'll back away from. I think there's a strong move toward service, and toward, frankly, centralizing policy decisions in the foundation rather than in the community organizations. So there's a lot more seizing control of the policy agenda, and that's happening nationally too, right? Where you see these sort of nationally based campaigns, even on our side, where instead of the process that used to happen, which is like we're interested generally in anti-poverty work, right? And organizations put in, here's what we think about that, here's what we think about that, and they fund some of them. Now it's like we're initiating an anti-poverty campaign, and here's the role that we want organizations to play. Are you willing to play this specific role? And they're doing a lot more sort of managing from the top, what happens in the nonprofit world. And I think that that really diminishes the bottom-up community voice that we're trying to raise. Yeah?
Steve, Ruth again. How does NAC do what they do? What do they do? And, is your member... Who are your membership?
Sure.
Who is your membership?
So the core technology, I've yet to find a better one, for what we do, is door knocking. We get out in the neighborhood and actually see what's going on in the neighborhood and talk to people about what's actually going on in the neighborhood. And that's by far the most important thing. I think Zuckerberg imagines a future where Facebook is somehow effective, for communicating with people that way. But if we actually want to build something between people, we need to get them in a room together and we need to talk face to face.
So identify problems.
Mm-hmm. Identify things that people want to work on. And then, right, I mean, sort of look at the issue and figure out what would it take to actually move it, right? So in some cases, what we found, like, we did a lot of conversations with our members about education, right? And one of the things we found, people had suddenly gotten really fired up about schools, and the reason was that they had just gotten these letters from the federal government that said, your school's a failing school, and your school district is going to be given a month to figure out how they're going to turn it around using these four very aggressive and top-down options, right? And people were really scared and mad about it, and understandably so. In some cases, they were mad that their school was failing. In some cases, they were mad because they felt like test scores had shown the wrong thing, and they didn't feel like their school was failing, and they didn't want to see those turnarounds happen to their school. They liked the principal that had just come in, who hadn't had a chance to really do their thing yet. But in any case, people were really angry. And, we had to look pragmatically at, like, well, what can we do about that? We're this Minnesota-only organization. We have one senator on the education committee, but we have fairly limited power, right? So I mean, we'll go, talk to Senator Franken's office and see where he is on this. And he kind of agrees with us, and that's great. But there are limits to how effective that was going to be. We sought out a coalition to build our power, right? And we found a national coalition we could be part of to work on this at the federal level. And we've actually gotten the Department of Education, through that process. We held local events in support of it that got some press, and other groups did that all around the country, and we've actually gotten the Department of Education to change their community engagement guidelines around that turnaround process, which is, kind of an exciting victory. In some cases, it's really obvious what needs to happen. North High School was slated for closure. What we needed to do was pack that school board room full, right? And we were part of a big coalition that did exactly that. One person asking for North High to stay open wouldn't have gotten it done. 400 of us, we managed to get it done. And so sometimes you just have to look at, does it take 400 of us or 4,000 of us or 400,000 of us, and like do the real power analysis to say, what do we actually need to move an agenda? And then figure out a way to get that number of people. And if you don't have that number of people, maybe walk away from that issue and work on something more manageable. I mean, the classic community organizing example is the stop sign, right? And so, like, you go into a community and what you hear from everybody around a few blocks is, like, we need a stop sign. And nobody in the neighborhood feels like they can get it on their own, but you can get to city council with 20 people, and that's usually enough to get a stop sign. We're obviously trying to think about things that are a little bigger than stop signs. But that's the, that's the mechanics of it, right?
Your members are?
Oh, our members are predominantly African-American. But pretty diverse. Our members are disproportionately from North Minneapolis, the east side of St. Paul, and Frogtown Rondo, and Phillips. They are almost all people who are either currently someone you describe as low income or have been and have real experience with that. And they're all people who got involved with us largely because they saw an issue that we were working on that they were passionate about, right? I mean, that's usually why people get engaged.
Any position on the NRP versus City of Minneapolis establishment fight?
No.
Okay. Do you know about it?
I do, yeah. Yeah. So here's the thing. There are neighborhood associations that are fantastic, that do amazing work. And there are neighborhood associations that are actually really regressive, that are actually in a very diverse neighborhood, are a group of a few middle-class white homeowners who have not reached out to anybody else and are making decisions for the whole community. And I frankly don't think that it's improving democracy to put money in their hands, because they're not representing a broader constituency. It's just like a few different people from the city council. And so do I want the Harrison neighborhood to get as much funding as we can give them right now for the stuff they're doing, because they're doing amazing organizing in multiple languages and like really engaging their community? Yeah, absolutely. Are there some neighborhood associations, including the one I live in the Sheridan neighborhood, that need some work? Yeah. And it's hard for me to get too fired up about NRP as a democracy issue, the way people have talked about it, when so many of the neighborhood associations are just not operating in an inclusive way. So I want to challenge the neighborhood associations to live up to the democracy that they're talking about, if they want to really get us to take a position on NRP.
City has done this enormous, talk about a corporate power grab.
Yeah.
And the answer is, can we get some kind of results-based analysis that shows us where money ought to go because a good job is being done?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you could measure it by...
It was an issue we were about to win in the legislature when it got tied up in the end of the session. So it's now lost unless the city does something.
Yeah.
Wondered if that was in any of the organizing.
It is. Well, this is a classic example, right? And there are so many of them, of situations where the failure to include a broad, diverse community really weakens the position on the issue, right? And almost all the time, if you're planning a labor strike, if you're trying to get somebody elected, if you don't include a broad base, then when you need a broad base, when you're under attack, it's going to be harder to motivate people, right? And so I would say that most of our base are people who feel pretty excluded from a lot of the neighborhood associations as it is. So we're sitting on the sidelines. And I think that's probably not where the neighborhood associations want us right now. I think they'd rather have us as allies. I want to challenge everybody to just think about as you do whatever work you do, right, in whatever movement it is, whether it's the environmental movement or the labor movement or... local neighborhood work, to be more inclusive and to get more people engaged, because we'd go to the mat for it if it was something that we had a voice in a serious way.
You recognize whoever you want.
Oh, okay, great, sure.
I love that. Two things to follow up. First, on the NRP thing and Phyllis's point. I live in the Uptown neighborhood, and mm-hmm. I'm closely involved with two neighborhood associations, East Calhoun, which is quite affluent, and Carrig right next door, which is much, much less affluent, and like 80% renters. And
mm-hmm.
Echo is fantastically organized, as you would imagine, and they were major advocates for the other neighborhoods who hadn't had their funding requests in earlier because they aren't as organized, and they were major advocates for those low-income neighborhoods. So that's, I think, a cool example of a broad-thinking coalition mm-hmm. sort of thing. And we've kind of lost sight of what was happening on that NRP thing. We need to go back to that. But my second point really goes right to that we have to put we as a as progressives who believe in our community, and we have to put all of our things into a big picture
And so it's all heading in the right direction, and not instead of feeling like we're competing for turf, and they're always competing for money. That happens, but that thinking, the divergence of where the right wing is going and where the left wing is flailing about is really got to be at the forefront.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Funny.
I didn't ask that.
Okay, question about...
I'm sorry, we haven't heard from...
Hi, my name is Ann. And I want to say, I think, in addition to all this, I've worked for many U.S. senators and members of Congress as staff. And I think also sometimes we need to be aware of the structure of our campaigns and how well we do our campaign, whether it's issue or candidate, and there are tools available to us, which when you said after Prop 8, a lot of times it's the after and the analysis or the failure and what the right and these people are doing, right? They're planning ahead. And I know that in the campaigns I work for, the successful ones, this planning was up front.
Mm-hmm.
And part of working well, I think, in a democracy is that we understand very well what the gap is, what don't people know, how do we need to do the education piece. So it's all those moral issues we talk about, but it's important within the structure that we use tools available to us, and that's always a challenge to pay for survey research and some of those things, but sometimes instead of looking at Prop 10 and going to a county like... Before I came, right. I was born and raised in Minnesota, but I've spent years in California, and I was at Cal State University, Monterey Bay. So Santa Cruz County is the People's Republic, right?
Well, the north part of the county. I helped organize the first Pride Parade in Watsonville.
That's the poor, and that is the migrant workers. Like, it's next to our neighbor, Pebble Beach, and the migrant workers in Monterey County.
Right.
But again, if we can't help and bring together people because we don't understand what their fears are, then their participating in a democracy is uninformed. And the basis of a democracy is information.
Yeah.
And I think we need to take a little bit of time to think about how we run these campaigns up front, because I really do think the right has been very successful in doing things up front instead of in hindsight.
Mm-hmm. I think that's right, and I think what's really important is that we do both at the same time. Is that I think there are definitely people who let themselves get so caught up in the research, and so caught up in making sure they're right before they take a step that we don't get to take a step, right? And so one of the things that we're really trying to balance is both of those things. We just finished, actually, and we'll be releasing a report in September, a survey that we did with several hundred parents in the Minneapolis and St. Paul school system. That we partnered with, this is actually a really exciting partnership. We're working with the Annenberg Institute for School Reform out of Brown University, who kind of helped us write the questions and situate the questions within the ongoing debates that are happening in other cities where other people are doing good organizing and sort of use the best of what we're learning from a lot of different places around the country. At the same time, we also partnered with the teachers unions at MFT and SPFT so that we can do a teacher version of the survey, and so that they can be involved in these discussions too. And our idea is we want to really figure out, you know, where's their alignment? What's going, you know, what are parents really feeling about what's happening in the schools? And how can parents and teachers solve those problems together? And it's been a really exciting collaboration between us and the teachers and the Annenberg Institute. And so we're really using kind of the best of all of the sort of research and institutional power and community power and figuring out how to do that work. At the same time, if we had stopped to just do that, there's this budget fight going on, right, that we had to be involved with while we were doing the survey. That we had to walk and chew gum at the same time. And there's, because if the schools don't have any funding next time around, none of the things we're asking for are going to happen. So we have to both figure out how to get some money to the schools so that our demands can be listened to with any kind of... you know, reality, but we also have to really, like, spend some time getting to know the community, and we did learn some stuff. There's some things that we were surprised by in the survey results.
Who funds your organization?
So we're funded through a combination of membership dues. We ask all of our members to pay dues. And right now about 300 of them are doing that. We are also funded through some of our union partnerships. So this Minnesotans for a Fair Economy that I just handed out has involved some funding to help us be part of that campaign. And we are funded through that national coalition that I mentioned, the Coalition for Excellent Public Schools. It's worth mentioning, because a few people asked this, we've not gotten a single dollar of tax money from either the state or the federal government. And we've gotten a little bit of foundation money, right? Headwaters Foundation and the Minneapolis Foundation have both gotten involved with us. So that's the kind of a mix of funding.
Yeah. I want to say something about election. I know we started with saying they're not important. It doesn't do us very much good to look at this district because it's kind of irrelevant as to what happens here. But my friend Bill Hilty, who comes from Hinckley, which is kind of right in the middle of the state, analyzed his 2010 election with his 2008 election. And the sense that there was this big, huge surging of Tea Party people did not happen. In his race, he looked at it, 800 less Republicans voted and 4,000 less Democrats voted. And that's 4,000 was part of the 15,000 Democrats that didn't vote that unelected Oberstar. And the only election I was really hoping, of course, when the Senate got so close, I modified that hope. The election I really wanted the Democrats to lose was Harry Reid's. Because if he had, if he had lost, that nuclear waste would have gone into Yucca Flats so fast you wouldn't have even seen it. And that would have been a civic lesson that the country could have understood, you know, whereas the Oberstar seems a little abstract.
But, right.
You know, that's not just an individual person. It's like the position that they hold. You know, when people Daschle and Tom Foley were able to be unelected because and Tim Walz at this event I was said, if you ever want to have any idea what's wrong with politics or anything, he said, as quoting Winston Churchill, just spend 5 minutes talking to one member of the electorate and you'll understand what the problems are.
Sure.
So, I don't know. You know, I just happen to think that the elections are critical the next time in terms of what happens. So.
Well, I think, so let's talk about what happened in Hilty's district, because part of the problem, why didn't people show up, right? I mean, why were Democrats so unmotivated? I'm going to tell you, I think we're doing a lot right now to kill energy in the progressive movement. I think we're doing a lot right now to say... I actually think that what we're doing is critical to Democrats starting to win again. I mean, I'll put on my partisan hat in the last 3 minutes here, and you know, maybe we'll get in trouble or not. But let me just say, the conversation we were having with voters in 2010 did not motivate them to vote, right? We need to, like, whatever else we say, we have to agree on that. The conversation we were having with voters in 2010 did not motivate them to vote. So we need to change the conversation. The conversation we were having, the only person out there saying tax the rich who was actually, like, kind of on message with something a little more aggressive was Mark Dayton, who won. In general, the messaging was really playing it safe. And it was, I mean, I think the sampling in this room is really interesting, right? Where, like, when we start to say, like, let's get aggressive about the corporate power that's really intervening in our lives, a lot of people are like, whoa, slow down there. I mean, I know that guy, or I'm not sure we want to paint with that brush. And I don't disagree with you, right? Like, I understand the tendency. I actually, like, I honor that. I have some friends who do some things I really disagree with, right? And Jim Campbell has done some really great stuff in addition to some of the stuff that he's done.
That goes with that.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, whose money is it in the bank? It's not all Jim Campbell's money in the bank. I have some money in Wells Fargo, too, that I need to have protected. Not that I'm, you know, arguing against what you're saying.
Sure.
But there's another side to the issue.
Yep. But I think is happening is that if we let ourselves get too into nuance, if we're talking to a broad electorate, and if we're talking, I mean, nobody in North Minneapolis, I mean, for the most part, I mean, the average wealth in North Minneapolis is less than $5,000, right? People aren't thinking about where do I protect my money. They really could keep it under a mattress and basically be okay, right? In terms of, like, whatever interest opportunities they're missing or whatever. So if you're actually really like trying to engage people in our base about politics, and you're not talking to them about the corporations that are refusing to hire them because they had a felony 12 years ago, and you're not talking to them about the ways that money is getting taken out of all the institutions they care about, because they can see the money's going away, right? They know there's a lot less programming in the parks. They know there's a lot less programming in the schools. They know that they feel like the quality of just about everything is going down, and it's being replaced with some nonprofits with some kind of unstable funding. And they, I mean, everybody understands that really bad things are happening. And frankly, this is more than just in the neighborhoods where we're the most dense, right? People understand right now that they're hurting, and people understand that somebody's doing it to them. And if we can't get honest about that conversation, even with our friends, even with the people who we feel like are on our side on some things or who are doing some good things with their money, we need to get serious about talking about inequality and talking about the things that people are really feeling, because the conversations that we're having are firing people up. People are wanting to get out and talk. People are wanting to get out and rally. People are wanting to get out and really make some things happen. And I think if the conversation in a year is about corporate power and how do we regulate it and how do we create a more moral, just Minnesota, right? I mean, seriously, like, think about what came out of the conversation in this room. I actually think we could win, right? And so, Ruth, we'll let you kind of close us out with, we got 1 minute.
Where can we get the biggest bang for the buck, okay? And I was thinking about what Ann was saying, and I think messaging is really where I would like to see us, we progressives, focus. What the other radical right does so well, or the not-so-radical right, is focus. They pick an issue or two issues, and that's it. And we are everywhere wanting to do the good wherever it may fall. So we walk a fine line, I think, between galvanizing people around an issue and saturating the the constituency with Harsdorf and Moore to the point where I was turning the station. I'd had it. So I really think that messaging is going to be the key and focus. So I'm hoping that
let me just say I actually think that as a movement we actually did a tremendous messaging job, and we certainly put the money into messaging and put the resources into messaging.
We as a movement.
I mean, I think specifically I'll call out Alliance for a Better Minnesota as being a really I mean, they really saturated, and they really had a lot of resources, and they really had a lot of money, and they did all of that, right? And that worked in the governor's race.
His message was crystal clear.
Right, and so what I just want to say is, I actually the message that I'd give you from NOC is that the bang for our buck, the place where we really need to invest, is in organizing, right? Is in organizing now, is in getting out in all of the communities that we want to be organized in, and NOC will do it in our base communities, and there are other groups doing it. I mean, Take Action's doing a great job out in some other communities. They're doing an amazing job organizing the Hmong community. They're doing an amazing job in some of the suburban communities that they're targeting. There are some other really great groups that are doing good stuff. Isaiah's organizing in a faith-based way and getting people involved. A lot of the labor unions are starting to reach out beyond their membership and start to really engage people in what's going on. We need to get out and build relationships with people so that when that redistricting happens, because we don't even know who lives where, right? We can't target legislative districts yet. But what we do know is that if we have really strong relationships with a whole bunch of people across the state who can actually be mobilized as leaders and who we're actually hearing from, we can actually get something done. And so that's my message, is like, messaging's important, but we need to get out and talk to people one-on-one. Nothing has ever, ever, ever moved an important agenda, especially a people's agenda that's up against corporate power, without one-on-one conversations where we both message and listen.
Right.
Right? And I think that's it for our time.
Yes,
all right.
You.
Thanks.